50. Additional information on programs available at 244-9141.
In sports this afternoon, Cubs ace Carlos Zambrano has right rotator cuff tendonitis and inflammation. An MRI has confirmed. This is a blow to Chicago's chances of winning the World Series for the first time in a century. Zambrano received a shot of anti-inflammatory medication and hopes to return to the rotation next week. General Manager Jim Hendry said Zambrano is to start throwing again when the team begins a series in St. Louis on September 10th. If all goes well, Zambrano would start at Houston in the following series. The Cubs, Cards, and the White Sox all have the day off today. Unable to return to his past Pro Bowl form after suffering a major knee injury in 2005, veteran quarterback Dante Culpepper retired from the NFL today. Culpepper starred with the Minnesota Vikings before his devastating injury and tried unsuccessfully to resuscitate his career with Miami in 2006 and Oakland in 2007. He was not in training camp with any teams this year. The first round of the BMW Championship has been washed out by steady rain in St. Louis. The plan now is to play the opening round tomorrow with 36 holes scheduled for Saturday to get the FedEx Cup playoff event back on schedule. Four-time reigning champion and second seed Roger Federer will be playing for a semifinals berth at the U.S. Open when he takes the court this afternoon to face Gilles Muller. Third-ranked Novak Djokovic plays his quarterfinal tonight against number 8 seed Andy Roddick. And South Carolina kicks off this week's top 25 college football schedule in Nashville tonight. The 24th-ranked Gamecocks will be looking to avenge last season's loss to Vanderbilt when they met the Commodores in their SEC opener. That's a look at sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the licensed professionals at Body Therapy Shop, dedicated to helping clients relieve stress-induced muscle or joint pain with therapeutic massage, body work, and physical therapy services. Located in the Lincoln Square Village, Urbana, with more information on the web at bodytherapyshop.com.
National political conventions are known primarily for the primetime speeches, but attendees also go to dinners, tourist attractions, fundraisers, and parties. Mary Welling wanted to do all that and more this week in Minneapolis, St. Paul. She's 82 years old, and this is her first time being a delegate. Chicago Public Radio's Robert Wildebohr spent the last couple of days trying to keep up with her. He has this report.
Right now, you're probably thinking that's hyperbole, right? The part about me not being able to keep up with an 82-year-old woman? Oh, would that it were so. I first met Mary Welling after the delegation breakfast a couple days ago. She was chatting with two other delegates she'd just met.
Lou Piniella, I think, has done a very good job. He's got to keep, you know, Carlos Zambrano in tow.
On this day, after breakfast, Welling has some free time, so she's decided she wants to conquer one of the largest shopping centers in the country, the Mall of America. After getting some directions in the hotel lobby, she takes off down the street in the rain.
I think we've got about an eight-block walk.
Welling walks fast. I'm 6'3 and a pretty fast walker. She's faster. Soon, she's hopping on the train.
I was a short walk. We were here before we knew it.
Welling finds a seat and tells me how she ended up at the convention. She's an accidental delegate. She agreed to get signatures for John McCain and dutifully sent them in. Then, on the day of the primary election, she got a call.
One of my friends called, said, Mary, you're on the ballot here. Do you want us to vote for you? I says, what ballot? I was on the public ballot as a delegate for McCain. Well, I said, I don't care.
Welling is a retired school teacher from Rock Island, Illinois, near the Illinois-Iowa border. For 14 years of her career, she taught a class that had mentally handicapped kids and kids with behavioral problems and kids with learning disabilities all in one room at the same time. After telling me a few more stories, we get to the mall, and Welling makes a beeline for the women's section at Macy's and finds some good deals.
This is what I'm looking for in a blue.
She tries on some clothes, but nothing fits quite right. So she goes back to the hotel for lunch and then heads to a fundraiser featuring Mitt Romney. I meet up with Welling in the evening at the Excel Center where all the speeches are taking place. She splits her time there between listening to the speeches and chatting up famous people.
Just got a picture of Karl Rove.
As we talk, she darts off every few minutes.
Oh, Greta Van Susteren.
Former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich passes by, as does Rudy Giuliani, and then she's off again.
Oh, Henry Kissinger. Oh, Mr. Kissinger.
When Mitt Romney takes the stage, Welling stands up and cheers him on. But when Sarah Palin steps up to the mic, Welling sits quietly, looking up at the large screen on the scoreboard at the top of the arena. Welling liked what she considered Palin's one-liners criticizing Barack Obama, but she expected to hear more about how Palin would govern as VP.
I was listening intently to see what she, you know, what she was going to offer. And I don't know if there was a lot of substance to it.
Welling says she was too far from Palin to gauge her, but she says she's confident she'll get to meet Palin before the election. Given all the people I've seen her chase down, I don't doubt it at all. In any case, being at the convention has Welling in high spirits. She's more convinced than ever that John McCain is the right choice for president.
It just fired me up. Now, I got to get going now. Mary, we only got so many days. I'm thinking, we only got so many days to the election. I got to get going now.
Welling says the high point of the convention was when the crowd sang the national anthem, and she could hear all the men around her joining in. She says she knows the country needs improvement, but she's tired of the negativity implicit in Obama's message of change.
Oh, America has to change. We're in trouble here, we're in trouble there. To me, America is still the greatest country.
Even though it's nearly 11 p.m., Welling's planning to stick around the convention hall for a while, and there's a party she's thinking of going to after that. From the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I'm Robert Wildeboer.
When Barack Obama was at his Democratic convention last week, John McCain was spending time in the critical state of Ohio. Now that John McCain is at his Republican convention, Barack Obama is spending time in the critical state of Ohio. NPR's Audie Cornish is with the Obama campaign and has this report.
Gabrielle Nevin, a single mom and student on the Kent State Tuscarawas campus, set the tone for the event, introducing Barack Obama through her own story.
I believe that this man right here, Barack Obama, understands my struggle because he has seen it firsthand as he was raised by a single mother who was juggling school and work. And I've heard that he has a plan to help women like me.
More than 200 people, mostly women, turned out for the invitation-only event on the economy. It was set in a campus garden courtyard. Obama evoked the experiences of Nevin, his own mother, his grandmother, and even his two daughters in drawing out his connections to issues that affect working women.
And yet, we still have a situation where women are making 77 cents to every dollar that a man makes on the job. Which is why, that's right, boo. And that's why what I've said is that when I am president of the United States, we are going to pass equal pay for equal work. It is a simple principle. It is a basic principle. It is one that we are going to make sure is in place when I'm president of the United States of America.
Obama followed that up with a hit list of economic platform issues, including his pledge to cut taxes for 95% of the middle class and his plan to generate jobs for the economy by spending federal dollars on boosting green technology and rebuilding America's roads, bridges, and other aging infrastructure.
And if people tell you that we can't do it, you just remember that we are spending $10 billion a month in Iraq when the Iraqis have $79 billion in surplus that they have parked in a New York bank account and are getting interest for. And I don't think that makes much sense.
Obama battled over women voters with Hillary Clinton in the primaries and will likely face another challenge with the introduction of Governor Palin to the GOP ticket. Obama managed not to utter Palin's name more than twice all day, although it was clear that the Republican vice presidential nominee wasn't too far from his mind.
People ask me, what have you learned about America as you've traveled through 49 states? The one I've missed is Alaska, which, you know, I'm thinking now I should have gone up there.
Later in the day, Obama attended a barbecue across the state. He stood before hay bales and sunflowers doubled over from the heat, and he gave rural voters an earful about his rivals.
Everybody talked about John McCain's biography, but nobody talked about how are you going to make the middle class more stable and more solid, and how are you going to create jobs, and how are you going to grow the economy. Nobody talked about that. And I wouldn't either, I guess, if I had the same record that they had over the last 8 years.
Voters here say Obama will need to keep up those jabs if he wants to win over the state his predecessor failed to capture in the last few general elections. Audie Cornish, NPR News, traveling with the Obama campaign.
We hear a lot about the coming hydrogen economy. Hydrogen has a lot of promise because it's a clean-burning gas. But for the most part, you have to burn dirtier fossil fuels to make hydrogen. Scientists can produce hydrogen from water, but the process is expensive. Julie Grant reports on new science that has researchers buzzing.
MIT researcher Daniel Nocera has found a cheaper way to get hydrogen from water molecules. Researchers already have been able to do this, but only with a precious metal, platinum. It costs up to $2,000 an ounce. Nocera's team discovered a material based on cobalt that does the same job, but cobalt only costs about $2 an ounce. James McCusker is an expert on solar energy conversion at Michigan State University. He says the discovery has researchers excited.
A, it works, but B, it works in such a way that it's very, very easy to put together, and it's made of very, very inexpensive materials. They're really potentially game changers in terms of this field.
McCusker says there's still a lot of work left before we're ready for a hydrogen economy. The new research was published in the journal Science. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
The wind turbine industry has made changes to reduce the number of birds killed by the spinning blades, but scientists are finding that more bats are being killed. Rebecca Williams reports one research team thinks it now knows why.
It's been a mystery why bats are getting killed by wind turbines. They're usually great at avoiding collisions because they sense moving objects even better than still ones. A team from the University of Calgary looked at dead bats near turbines. They found that 90% of the bats had internal bleeding. Erin Berwald is the lead author of the study. She says there's a sudden drop in pressure near the tips of the turbine blades. And when bats fly close enough, the pressure drop makes their lungs overexpand and burst. She thinks the bats are attracted to the turbines.
Maybe they see these tall turbines as trees.
That's because most of the bats that are getting killed are tree-roosting bats. Berwald says researchers are looking at ways to change turbines to avoid killing bats. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
One of the most anticipated video games ever is finally coming out this weekend. It's called Spore. There's a lot of excitement about this video game because it's created by Will Wright, the man who designed the popular SimCity and The Sims. His latest creation takes its inspiration from evolutionary biology, and for the most part, scientists are giving it a thumbs up. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
It took 7 years for Will Wright to finish Spore.
Why did it take so long?
It's kind of a hard game to make.
The game is about nothing less than 1 billion years of evolutionary history.
So basically, you start as this microscopic cell. Eventually, you kind of leave water. You continue to evolve for many generations.
You start the game in primitive waters, eating algae and trying not to get eaten. When you've grown enough, you can find a mate.
Then we mate, and what we're going to do now is lay an egg for the next generation of our species. And this is how I get back into the editor. So I'm basically designing the next evolution of my species.
The editor is where you can add features to your creature. A new mouth, a nicer nose, faster fins, in later stages, faster legs, a bigger brain. You buy them with points you get from eating.
If you step way back, you know, evolution is about incremental improvement of a species embedded in a larger ecosystem over large periods of time. And that was kind of like the general presentation, the toy that we wanted to build of evolution.
To create Spore, Wright consulted with biologists and other scientists to get a greater understanding of the process of evolution.
Once you see this, you'll never think about abalone the same way.
Okay.
In this scene from a National Geographic documentary about Spore, Will Wright is consulting with marine biologist Tierney Tease.
Okay. Is this its mouth?
This is its mouth.
Ooh, that's cool. Looks like some kind of mechanical
buzzsaw.
Grinder.
Yeah, and that's what we call radula.
I was sat with Will and had the pleasure of introducing him to a lot of really crazy animals out there that don't get a lot of silver screen time. Things like a radula. It's a buzzsaw-like mouth apparatus of mollusks.
Tees says the game isn't really a true mirror of nature, but she does believe it may help young people get interested in science.
I think there's so much potential for perhaps incorporating it into animal diversity classes. Or going tide pooling and then seeing mixing and matching, using the natural world as your inspiration for your virtual world.
Will Wright has built a career on games drawn with great detail. From there, he creates entire worlds that mimic the real one, says Chris Swain, a professor at the School of Cinematic Arts at USC. The Sims, which recreated the life of a real family, relied on behavioral science. Swain says follow-up game SimCity lets players take up real issues of urban planning.
And you get these 10-year-olds that can make these very sophisticated statements about what they need to do to their city to make it prosper. Lower the tax base and we'll raise the revenue here. And they say things that a mayor would say.
Spore gets even bigger. Your creature evolves into a species that develops a civilization that can be warlike or, as Wright explains, religious.
And we're going to go over to our neighbors here and try to convert them. Now, it's going to be a little hard because they're fairly happy, which is their best defense against religious conversion.
Depending on how your creature has evolved, whether it's been through dominance or cooperation, will determine what kind of cities you build during the civilization phase. Eventually, your civilization can conquer space. Spore goes on sale in the U.S. this Sunday, but already people are taking advantage of a preview where they can create creatures and share them online. There are more than 3 million to be found, waiting for their chance to evolve, mate, and eventually conquer the universe. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Earth and sky.
Scientists have drilled closer than ever into an active earthquake zone.
We know that there are future magnitude 8 earthquakes coming.
That's geophysicist Harold Tobin of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's chief scientist with a Japanese research vessel called the Chikyu, which drilled 1.4 kilometers, or nearly a mile, into the Nankai Trough off the coast of Japan.
What we want to do is try to use that as essentially a field laboratory to study the earthquake process and maybe help us understand how to know when earthquakes are coming or what makes big ones big, small ones small, and the differences between earthquakes.
Tobin and colleagues have taken three-dimensional images of stresses inside the quake zone.
We have a very sophisticated drill pipe, actually, that has sensors embedded in it. And those sensors can measure properties of the rock. We can also take core samples of the rock, so we bring them up on the ship, and then there's a sophisticated laboratory where the geologists can study those core samples.
The holy grail of earthquake science, Tobin said, is to be able to predict the day and even the time when a major earthquake might occur. But there's a long way yet to go.
The real point that we're at right now is to get into these faults and learn enough about them to understand whether earthquakes are in fact even predictable, whether anything that's measurable takes place far enough in advance to see it.
That's our show for today, where Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org. Support.